This morning to Acts chapter 21. We are picking up again in our study of the book of Acts, and we are in Acts chapter 21. Now, we haven't done this for a while. I haven't tested you for a while, so let's see what's the structure that the book of Acts follows. It's found in Acts chapter 1, verse 8. Oh, Ben. Praise the Lord. Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, to the ends of the earth. That really is the structure. And we kind of are in a significant portion of the book of Acts now, because in the context of the book of Acts, the gospel reaching Rome, or certainly Paul reaching Rome, was symbolic of the ends of the earth. The gospel hasn't got to the ends of the earth. We today are still in the process of taking the gospel to the ends of the earth, but within the context of the book of Acts, Paul's arrival in Rome is symbolic of that. And so this is another turning point, another important turning point in the book of Acts. And it begins, as we will see this morning, with Paul's arrest. Now, for the rest of the book of Acts, and indeed for the rest of his ministry and the rest of his life, Paul will be a prisoner. This marks the end of his time as a free man, and for the rest of his life he will be a prisoner. And in this section of Acts that describes Paul's journey to Jerusalem and then his arrest and his trials, Luke seems to be drawing a deliberate parallel between the sufferings of Jesus and the sufferings of Paul. Now, obviously, Jesus' suffering was redemptive. Paul's suffering is not necessarily redemptive in the same way. But there are some obvious parallels. In the last chapter, which was a long time ago now, so you'll be forgiven if you don't remember, but in the last chapter we saw the similarities between their respective journeys to Jerusalem. Now Luke takes it further. They were rejected by their own people, both of them arrested without cause and imprisoned. Both were beaten unjustly. Both were unjustly accused and willfully misrepresented by false witnesses. Both were victims of the Jews and their plots. Both had the Jewish crowd screaming, "Away with him." Both were subject to a series of five trials. Jesus by Annas, the Sanhedrin, King Herod, and twice by Pilate. Paul by the crowd, the Sanhedrin, King Herod Agrippa the Second, and the two procurators, Felix and Festus. Both took place over Passover. There are indeed obvious similarities, and they should remind us of Jesus' warnings to his disciples, where he said that everyone who puts their trust in him will be persecuted because of him, for his name's sake. And so we too, as we sit here this morning, if we are indeed Christ's and we live a righteous life, we will be persecuted, and we should expect that. Now, the question I want to ask you this morning is, how do you view your trials? How do you view persecution and the trials that you face? When you are persecuted for your faith, how do you respond? When life seems unfair, when things don't go as planned, what do you do? When you are falsely accused, what is your primary concern? In Acts 21, the Apostle Paul finds himself facing all of these. He was targeted because of his faith in Jesus Christ. He was misrepresented. He was falsely accused. He was arrested. He was beaten without cause. He was arrested. And we will see this morning that his primary cause was not to defend himself, but to defend his faith. Paul's response is an incredible example of how we can use trials and how we can use persecution as an opportunity to share our faith. That's what we're going to see this morning. Let's read our passage. It is quite long, Acts 21. We're going to start in verse 27. And we will read until the end of verse 1 of chapter 22. So Acts 21, starting in verse 27. When the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. And he inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing and some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. For the mob of people followed, crying out, "Away with him!" As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense I now make before you." So just by way of reminder, Paul has completed his missionary journey back to Jerusalem, his third missionary journey, and he has come back to Jerusalem. And he came back to Jerusalem with a gift, a large sum of money from the Gentile churches to give to the poor saints in Jerusalem for the relief of the poor saints in Jerusalem. And you can imagine that he was probably expecting great joy from the church and gratitude from the church for this gift. And to a degree, it seems there was some, as indicated a bit earlier in chapter 21. But you'll also remember that at that point, Paul learned that rumors had been spread throughout the Jerusalem church about him. And the rumors were that he was teaching Jews who lived outside of Jerusalem, outside of Judea, to, like in other words, the Gentile Jews, to forsake the Jewish customs. And so at the recommendation of the elders, Paul had agreed to place himself under a Nazarite vow to show that he wasn't opposed to the Jewish rituals, to dispel these rumors. And at the time, there were four other men who were under a Nazarite vow, and so Paul joined them for the remainder of their vow, and to further prove that he was willing to submit himself to the Jewish customs, he paid for these men at great expense to himself. He paid for these men to complete their vow. And that was what the elders of the church recommended that he do, and so he did it. And the reason he did it was to show that he was not opposed to Judaism, but he in fact continued to observe the customs of the Jews. And these men had given notice that their vow was coming to an end, and that notice period lasted 7 days. And so here we see, this is where we're picking it up now. I'm going to lay out for you the situation that develops in this passage. We read in verse 27, when the 7 days were almost completed, that's the days of the notice period that the vow was coming to an end, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place." And so his Nazarite vow was coming to an end, and Paul was in the temple, and while he was there, the Jews from Asia saw him there, and they stirred up the crowd and they grabbed him. And they said, And they said that Paul was forsaking the Jews, the law in the temple. Now, the Jews from Asia, this was a province in Asia Minor, not Asia as we know it today. Sorry, the province of Asia Minor, not Asia as we think of it today. And what was one of the major cities in Asia in Paul's day? Ephesus. And Paul has just been in Ephesus, and he spent 3 years in Ephesus. And I would argue that these Jews from Asia are in fact Jews from Ephesus for two reasons. First of all, because as I say, Paul has just spent 3 years in Ephesus preaching the gospel. And the gospel had had great effect in Ephesus and the surrounding area. And even two of the leaders of the synagogue had converted to Christianity. And so the Jews from Ephesus hated Paul. The second reason is because if you look at verse 29, they recognized one of Paul's travel companions, a man named Trophimus, the Ephesian. And so because they recognized this Ephesian, it's highly likely that they too were Ephesians. And so most likely the Jews from Asia are Jews from Ephesus, and they stir up the crowd and they grab him and they say, this is the man teaching everyone everywhere against the people, the law, and this place. The accusation is threefold. He is against the Jewish people. He is against the Jewish nation, number one. Number two, he is against the Jewish law. And number three, he is against the Jewish temple. These were the three most sacred things to a Jew. To be a Jew, to have the law, and to worship in the temple was the essence of Judaism, to be God's people. And they say not only is Paul against these things, but he is teaching others against these things. Now, was Paul doing that? Was Paul opposed to these three things and teaching others against them? No! He wasn't, not at all. First of all, it would be impossible to teach everyone everywhere, right, against these things. So it's hyperbole, it's exaggeration. And secondly, he wasn't teaching anyone against Judaism. We must consider the irony of this situation. Why was Paul in the temple at that time? What was he doing? He was under a what? Nazirite vow. And why was he under the Nazirite vow? To prove to the people that he didn't oppose the law. The very purpose that Paul was in the temple at that point was to prove that he didn't oppose the Jewish people, the law, or the temple. That was why he was there. His presence in the temple at that time, and his purpose in the temple at that time, nullifies the accusations. But people with an agenda are really concerned with the truth. So far, though the accusations are serious, none of them are criminal. If Paul was opposed to Judaism, all they could do was kick him out. But there was no further action that they could take against him because he hadn't done anything that was criminal, so they needed a more serious accusation. And so we read that they say, moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place, for they had previously seen Trophimus, the Ephesian, with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Now here is the more serious accusation. In fact, this is one of the most serious accusations. You know that in the temple there was the Gentile court, which was part of the outer courts, but no Gentile was allowed beyond that into the inner courts. And the accusation here is that Paul had taken a Gentile into the inner courts of the temple and had, in doing so, defiled the temple, the holy place of God. This is a very serious accusation, and it was the punishment for any Gentile who went into the inner courts of the temple was death. He was put to death. And it was such a serious, it was so serious to the Jews that even the Roman government had agreed to uphold this law, such that even if a Roman citizen who was a Greek, not a Jew, went into the inner courts of the temple, their own government would put them to death. And they had hung signs on the dividing wall of the temple, written in Greek, that read, "No foreigner may enter within the barricade which surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone who is caught trespassing will bear personal responsibility for his ensuing death." Those were the signs hung on the dividing wall by the Roman authorities. This was now a serious accusation. Question, had Paul taken Trophimus into the temple? Of course not. To do so would have been incredibly foolish of him. He was in the middle of a vow to prove that he valued and upheld the Jewish law and the Jewish customs. Why would he undermine that by doing something as blatant and foolish as taking a Gentile into the temple? He wouldn't. These Jews who were making the accusation hadn't actually seen Trophimus in the temple. They had seen him in the city. But they supposed that Paul had taken him in. The reality is they actually just needed an accusation to trap Paul. And this was serious enough that it riled the crowds up. Now, again, even in this situation, even if Paul had taken Trophimus into the temple, who would have been the one held accountable? Trophimus. Who would have been put to death? Trophimus. Not Paul. But again, people with an agenda are rarely concerned with the truth. We read in verse 30, "Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut. And as they were seeking to kill him," we'll pause there. Now Paul was there for Passover, and historians tell us that as many as 2 million Jews might have traveled to Jerusalem for Passover. So the city was full. And it was full of people who were there to worship God for his kindness to them. And it was a time where Jews felt particularly patriotic. So there were a lot of people there, and they were incensed by this accusation that Paul might have taken a Gentile into the temple. So they dragged Paul out of the temple in order to kill him. A large crowd gathers, and they are so angry, they give Paul no trial, no hearing, no opportunity to speak or defend himself. They simply drag him out and start to beat him. All that they have on their minds is murder. And as they drag him out, we're told that they shut the gates. And most of the commentaries agree that the purpose in shutting the gates was so that they could continue with their Passover celebrations. So that while they killed Paul, or their murder of Paul, wouldn't interrupt their celebration of God. We see the emptiness of their worship, such that they can kill someone made in the image of God while simultaneously worshiping God. Now, this is reminiscent of Jesus' trial and his murder, which also took place during the Passover and was managed in such a way that it didn't break any of the Passover rules, so that it didn't interrupt any of their Passover celebrations. Again, the emptiness of the hypocrisy of their worship is so evident in this. I think it's also worth noting that this act of closing the temple doors also carries a symbolic significance. This act of shutting the gates of the temple on Paul was also symbolic of shutting the doors on the gospel. Previously, the temple had been the home of God's message and his messengers. But now they were closing the doors on God's message and his messenger. And F.F. Bruce, one of the commentators, writes or notes that the temple was now ripe for the destruction which Jesus had predicted for it many years before. I think the closing of the gates of the temple was symbolic of the rejection of the gospel by the Jewish people. Verse 31, "And as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune, how do you pronounce that word? Tribune. of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion, and he at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. So to the northwest of the temple stood Fort Antonia, and it had a tower that allowed soldiers to look down directly into the temple courts. It had been built there, connected to the temple purposefully, and it had this tower that allowed soldiers to look down into the temple, and it had a set of stairs that came down from the fort into the outer courts of the temple. And it was built like this purposefully to help the soldiers to manage and control potential uprisings that may have started in the temple. And during the time of Passover, because of the patriotic nature of the celebrations and because of the amount of Jewish people, the number of Jews who had come into Jerusalem, additional troops were dispatched to Jerusalem, and they were on high alert. And so there were constantly guards patrolling and keeping an eye on what was happening in the temple. And so they quickly pick up on this little, or not little, but this disruption that has occurred. And word of that comes quickly to the tribune who's in charge. Word of the scuffle gets to him fairly quickly, and he immediately took soldiers and ran down those stairs into the outer courts where Paul was being beaten. We read, and when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Now this, the swift arrival of this man and his troops saved Paul's life. They were intending to kill him, but this man arrives and they stopped beating him. Verse 33. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing and some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. Now this is typical of a mob and of mob mentality. They don't actually know why they're beating Paul. They just, someone started beating him and the rest thought this is a good idea and they joined in. This is similar to what we saw during the riot in Ephesus in Acts 19 verse 32. We read, now some cried out one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion and most of them did not know why they had come together. Mob mentality. They don't know why they're angry. They don't know why they're beating Paul, but they're doing it, right? They are in confusion. But I want you to see how angry this confused mob actually was. Verse 35. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd. For the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him!" So Paul's been arrested and the soldiers are taking him back to the barracks. And as they're taking him away, the crowd seemingly starts to want to beat him again. And so in order to get Paul away from this crowd who still want to kill him, the soldiers have to carry him. This is an undignified exit for Paul. Perhaps similar to being lowered in a basket from a window in a wall, right? Paul made numerous undignified exits in his life, and this was one of them. And as he's now carried away by this, can you imagine Paul bound in chains over the shoulder of a soldier being carried away? As he's being carried away, the Jews are shouting, "Away with him! Away with him!" Who else did they shout that for? Jesus. And away with him, what they're actually saying is away with him from the earth. They're saying, kill him! Kill him! Is what they are shouting. That's what they mean. And as they're shouting it, they're continuing to try and kill him. Now we will see Paul's response to this situation and to those who have made false accusations against him, to those who have unjustly beat him, to those who are seeking to kill him. We'll see Paul's response. And Paul's response is an incredible response in love. Verse 37. As Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, and the barracks would have been safety from this crowd, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." So, as he's being carried into the barracks, he's carried past the tribune and he says, "Can I speak to you?" But he says it in Greek. Now, this tribune man had made an assumption as to who Paul was. But he realizes now that his assumption is wrong. Jewish historian Josephus records that about 3 years before this, an Egyptian adventurer had come into Jerusalem claiming to be a prophet. And he led a band of men who hated the Jews, and they would kill Jewish people. And it came to a point where this man led his band of followers out to the Mount of Olives, and he told them to wait there until at his cry, the walls of Jerusalem would fall flat, and they would march into the city and overthrow the Roman garrison and take control of the city of Jerusalem. But Felix, who was the procurator of Jerusalem at the time, word came to Felix that this was the plan, and so Felix led Roman soldiers out to the Mount of Olives and disrupted this man's plan. He killed several hundred of them, but thousands of them escaped, along with their leader, this Egyptian, into the wilderness, where they went into hiding. However, periodically these men would come back into Jerusalem, often during the time of the feasts, when Jerusalem was busy and full of Jews. They would come back into Jerusalem, they would mingle with the crowds, they would often stab people with daggers, and then disappear back into the crowds. They still had this agenda. The tribune had arrested Paul, assuming that he was this Egyptian leader, that he was this rebel leader. But then Paul addressed him in Greek, which was the language of the educated. And he realized, this man is an educated man. He can't possibly be this Egyptian rebel. He realized that he had misidentified Paul. And this piqued his interest, because now he really wants to. Remember, he had asked who Paul was, and no one was able to give him a response because there was confusion. So he had made an assumption. He realizes his assumption is wrong, and Paul has now piqued his interest because he allows Paul to speak to the crowd. And let's just pause for a moment here before we look at Paul's address. And just imagine you were in a situation where you had been wrongfully accused. And these accusations had grown and grown and grown to the point where an angry crowd had grabbed you and started beating you. And their intention was to kill you. But before death, thankfully, the authorities show up. And they rescue you from this crowd. What would your response be? If you had an opportunity to speak to the crowd, and I think most of us probably wouldn't bear mentioning in a church what we would say to the crowd, but what would your response be? I'll tell you what my response would be. I'm innocent. Arrest these fools. And maybe slap them up a little bit while you're doing it. Right? I think that's what we would say. But not Paul. Paul is being carried away from this mob who are still seeking to kill him even while he is in the hands of the Roman guards. And he says, "Please let me speak to them." And you'll notice with Paul's response, he doesn't try and defend himself. He doesn't try and protest his innocence. He doesn't make any accusations against the crowd. He doesn't try and shame them or fault them or accuse them of beating him. Paul takes this opportunity to share the gospel with them. Paul's response is a response in love. Verse 40, "And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, 'Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you.'" Having addressed the tribune in Greek, Paul now addresses the crowd in the Hebrew language, which is not necessarily Hebrew. It's the language of the Hebrews, which is most likely Aramaic. And he calls them brothers. Brothers and fathers. Paul, brothers is a term of, of loving, of endearment. It's a Paul. It's a term of association. And fathers, Paul is putting himself under the authority of the Jewish leaders. So he starts his address with great humility and affection for these people who have just been seeking to kill him. And when he says, "Hear my defense," he's not saying, "Hear the defense," I'm not, that he's going to defend himself. He's saying, "Hear my testimony." This is an apologetic that he is going to, give. He's saying, "Hear the defense of my faith." He's going to give a reason for his faith, which is exactly what Peter told the dispersed Jews to be ready to do. In 1 Peter chapter 3, he wrote this letter to Jews who had been dispersed by persecution. And in 1 Peter chapter 3, he says, "But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake," persecution for faith in Jesus Christ, "even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ as Lord, Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is yours. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame." Paul wasn't asked for a defense, but he still took the opportunity to give a defense. Remember, this letter was written to people who had been persecuted for their faith. And Peter says, when you are persecuted, don't fear people. Honor God and take it as an opportunity to give a reason for the hope that you have. Friends, we must understand that persecution provides an excellent opportunity to share our faith. Persecution provides an excellent opportunity to share our faith. So much so that the Bible instructs us to always be ready in the face of persecution to share our faith. Do we view persecution through that lens? Do we view it as an incredible opportunity to tell people of the hope that we have in Jesus? But of key importance in utilizing persecution as an opportunity to share our faith, of key importance is that we understand that we do not need to defend ourselves in that moment. If our concern when we are persecuted is to defend ourselves, we will miss the opportunity to share the gospel. When Paul was persecuted here and he got up and addressed the crowd, he did not defend himself. Now, I want to be clear. Paul did use the avenues of protection that were available to him. We'll see that later in the chapter. He appeals to his Roman citizenship to avoid the beating that he's about to get. So he does use the channels of protection that were available to him. But when given this opportunity to address those who were beating him, he didn't try and defend himself. He shared the gospel. We are so preoccupied with trying to justify and defend ourselves that we miss so many opportunities to share the gospel. Do we not? Hand in hand with this is the reality that Paul rested in God's sovereignty. He knew that God was in control. And because he knew that God was in control, he didn't need to defend himself. Because God was in control, Paul didn't need to be in control. And so he was free to share his testimony, and he was free to share his faith. Friends, this is a point of belief that is contrary to our culture around us. We do not need to be in control. God is in control. And this kind of thinking in the world we live in is so far removed that it would be considered foolishness if we were in a situation and didn't try to take control. We would be considered foolish. But yet that's exactly what the Bible would encourage us to do in a situation like that. It doesn't mean that we simply lie down and do nothing. As I said, Paul used the channels of protection available to him. But it means that we acknowledge that God is in control and we are not. But because God is in control, we do not need to be in control, because we are His. Right? And everything He does for His glory and our good. Isn't that what we sang earlier? Even what the enemy means for evil, you mean it for my good. That's what Joseph said to his brothers. We can rest in God's sovereignty, even in times of persecution. Even when we can't necessarily see the good in the situation, we can rest in the knowledge that God is in control. And so Paul did not feel the need to urgently defend himself because he rested in the knowledge that God was in control. It's not explicit in our text. It doesn't explicitly say that in our text. But it is implicit. It is clear from Paul's actions and the speech that he gives. But it is also explicitly stated elsewhere. In Ephesians, for example, a letter that Paul wrote from Rome as a prisoner. Paul says in Ephesians 3 verse 1, I, Paul, a prisoner of who? How many of you know that verse? I, Paul, a prisoner of Christ. Not I, Paul, a prisoner of Rome. Paul didn't consider his imprisonment to be because of the will of Rome, but because of the will of who? God. He knew that he was a prisoner of Christ. Similarly, he says to the Philippians, he says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. This is his imprisonment as well. So that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Paul knew that his captivity was not according to the will of the Roman government, but according to the will of God. And so what did he use his time in prison to do? Advance the gospel. He was there because God desired him to be there, and so he used his time in prison to advance the gospel, not to plead his innocence, and not to mourn his situation, or feel sorry for himself, but to advance the gospel. Isn't that an amazing testimony? Doesn't that challenge you? That wherever we are there under the will of God and should use that as an opportunity to share the gospel. And as he's finishing, Paul, as he's finishing his letter to the Ephesians, he asks them to pray for him. And listen to what he asks them to pray for. He says, to that end, keep alert with all perseverance, making supplication for all of the saints and also for me, he says. That words may be given me in opening my mouth boldly to proclaim the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains, that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak. He doesn't say, pray that I will be freed. Pray that God will free me from these chains. He says, pray that I will be bold in proclaiming the gospel because I am an ambassador in chains. He knows that God is in control of his imprisonment, and here he knows that God is in control even as this crowd is beating him, and so he can use it as an opportunity to evangelize. Friends, this is a point that we need to understand, and we need to not just understand, but we need to believe it with all of our hearts, that God is always in control. Even when it doesn't seem like it, God is in control. Even when we can't see it, God is in control. He will never, ever lose control. He is God. And He holds us in the palm of our hand all of the time. He is always in control, and so we don't have to be. Isn't that a good thing? And this frees us up to use every situation we find ourselves in to share the excellencies of Christ. And what follows in the rest of the text is an incredible blueprint for how we can share our faith. And for the sake of time, I'm just going to give you the bullet points. I won't go through this in detail. We'll go through this next week, but with a different focus. What we find in verses 2 to 21 of Acts chapter 22 is Paul's testimony. He says, I'm going to make a defense before you. And then he shares his testimony and what God has done for him. And in verses 2 to 5, he says who he was. He says, please read along with me. I'm just going to read briefly these verses. This is who he was. Sorry, verses 3 to 5. He says, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus in Cilicia, brought up in this city, that's Jerusalem, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, as all of you are this day. He's saying, he's excusing their behavior and saying, I understand it. He says, I persecuted this way to the death, binding and delivering to prison both men and women, as the high priest and the whole council of the elders can bear me witness. From them I received letters to the brothers, and I journeyed towards Damascus to take those who were there and bring them in bonds to Jerusalem to be punished. And all of the Jews would have been saying, yes, that's our guy. But what's Paul's point in sharing this? He's saying, this is who I used to be. This is the sinful me. This is the prideful, sinful, old man. And in verses 6 to 11, he describes his encounter with Jesus, where he lost his sight, but his eyes were open to who Jesus is. He says, as I was on my way and drew near to Damascus, about noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, who are you, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom you are persecuting. Now those who were with me saw the light, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, rise and go into Damascus, and there you will be told all that is appointed for you to do. And since I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. Here Paul describes his encounter with Jesus, where, as I said, he lost his sight, but his spiritual eyes were opened. The veil was removed. In 2 Corinthians, he speaks about those who are perishing because their hearts are veiled to who Jesus Christ is. But here Paul says that veil was removed, and I saw Jesus and who he is. He encountered Jesus. And in verses 12 to 16, he describes his humiliation, his repentance, and his obedience in baptism. And one Ananias, a devout man according to the law, well spoken of by the Jews who lived there, came to me, and standing by me said, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very hour I received my sight and saw him. And he said, the God of our fathers appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear a voice from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to everyone of what you have seen and heard. And now, why do you wait? Rise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on his name. And then from verses 17 to 21, he describes the work that he has been given to do. He says, when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple, I fell into a trance and saw him saying to me, make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, Lord, they themselves know that in one synagogue after another, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of Stephen, your witness, was being shed, I myself was standing by and approving and watching over the garments of those who killed him. And he said to me, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. So Paul here describes his testimony. The old man who pursued sin and sinful gain in opposition to God. He had an encounter with Jesus where the veil was removed and he saw who Jesus is. And then he describes the new man who now lives in submission and obedience to Jesus Christ, and who takes the gospel to those whom Jesus has called him to take the gospel to. What I want you to see here is that Paul's defense is the hope that he has in Jesus Christ. Paul's defense is his testimony of what God has done for him. In Paul's testimony, he makes little of himself and much of God. And that's what our testimony is. It is the story of what God, it's the account of what God has done in our lives. Not because we are great or because we are worthwhile, but because of God's grace and His kindness to us. Despite the fact that we were sinners, God came and saved us and rescued us. And so when we face persecution, we don't have to come up with some elaborate theological defense of Jesus' lordship. But what do? We give an account of the hope that we have, which is the testimony of what God has done in our lives. And friends, our testimony should make much of God, not much of us. So, question, how did Paul view these trials and attacks? He viewed them as an opportunity. He viewed them as an opportunity to share his faith. How did he respond to those who persecuted him? He responded in love. And his primary concern was not to defend himself, but to share his faith, to defend his faith. And here we see how we can use persecution as an opportunity to share our faith. Here we see how we can turn a negative situation into a positive testimony where God is glorified. And I was just, as I was studying this, this is specifically talking about persecution, but there's also a sense in which the trials of life provide an opportunity to share our hope. And Geri came to my mind. Now, Geri faces a great trial at the moment. How many of you have spoken to Geri in the last couple of months? What exudes from him every time you speak to him? His hope in Jesus Christ. That's what exudes from the man. It's another wonderful example of how the trials in our life serve as an opportunity to share our faith. And my prayer is that as trials come for us, and as persecution comes for us, all those who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And so as these things come for us, my prayer is that we likewise would see them as an opportunity to share our faith, to share the reason for the hope that we have in Jesus Christ, and that through persecution and through trials and through hardship, that God would be glorified in us, and that we would serve the purpose for which we were saved, which is to make much of God and to share the faith and the gospel by which we were saved. Let's pray. Father God, what an amazing